This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 223, was recorded on June 11th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is dedicated to healthcare workers all over the world, the true heroes of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis, and is brought to you by TopTradersOnPlug.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Quadriga Asset Management portfolio manager and best-selling author Diego Parrilla returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the post-COVID-19 economic and market recovery, the coming transition to secular inflation, or perhaps more likely stagflation, precious metals, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick is going to guide us through how to put on spread trades using options. We'll be looking at both crude oil and treasury spread trades and how to put them on using options.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, what a day on the S&P 500. It's been almost up every single day. And it's like, when will this ever end? And then it's like the floodgate opened. We're down about 167 points at the time of recording. And we're back to almost a 3,000 level on the S&P. What's your take on all of this?
Well, needless to say, you know, I've been dumbfounded by the strength of this rally. It didn't make sense to me. I had thought it was going to top out at the 61.8 Fib retrace back down around 2930 or so, and we got all the way up to 3200. I was very interested in Stan Druckenmiller being quoted this week as saying that he was humbled by all the strength in the market. He called to the top around the same time that I did, and, you know, it went several hundred points more than either Stan or I thought was possible. You know, I'd love to interview that guy, Patrick, because one of the comments that he made in another interview a couple of years ago is he said, you know, I cut my teeth on old school, you know, back in the days when the market was driven by economic fundamentals, not by central bank policy. And I really think we've come into, a new normal where central bank policy is more important than the things that used to drive the market. Patrick, the thing that just dumbfounds me about this market is, although clearly we had the FOMC statement and their economic projections, and that is clearly feeding into part of what this market reversal seems to be doing, a lot of commentators, particularly mainstream media types, are saying this is all about the shocking revelation that it looks like there could be a second wave of the COVID-19 crisis. Anybody who thinks that's news is absolutely nuts. It has been so clear for so long, even before we had any protests, a lot of experts thought that a second wave was very likely, perhaps inevitable. And then you put hundreds of thousands of people with no social distancing, shoulder to shoulder, having riots and protests and so forth. Obviously, there's going to be another big wave of infections. That should surprise nobody. So the notion that that's part of what's driving the market reversal is if people are surprised by this revelation is just baffling to me. But, you know, I was baffled at the end of January and all through February when I thought the market should have been crashing because it was obvious that a pandemic was coming. And it wasn't really until March that it hit the tape. So maybe we're just having that same delayed reaction. In any event, I don't know whether we're going to get back to old normal rules, which would suggest a really big move down. A lot of us thought that the 2174 was not the bottom and that we should expect a bear market rally and then a new test of new lower lows. Are we still headed there, or is the next round of Fed stimulus going to carry us all the way up to new all-time highs? I think the jury's out, but the more that I see, the more, frankly, that I'm, you know, I don't want to short this market. I don't believe in the market. I don't want to be long, but I don't dare to short it because I don't know what the Fed is going to do next.
All right. Well, let's move on to the dollar because really this risk-off impulse has caused selling in the CAD, the Aussie, and the Euro all turning decisively lower as the U.S. dollar reverses off of some pretty oversold levels down at the 96 handle. What's your think? Is that at a short-term low here on the dollar?
Well, I think, you know, clearly for dollar bulls, it's nice to see that there is, you know, a bounce here. But boy, that was a really big and, to me at least, unexpected move to the downside. We didn't quite get down to testing that 94.50 level. But at this point, I think that this move really could be the beginning of something bigger. So it needs to be watched. I didn't think it was going to happen. Now that it has happened, we have to take it seriously. If we get a rally from here and manage to get back up and test the 99 handle again, which is where the breakdown occurred from, as often happens in technical analysis, if you get that next chance to sell 99, I might be tempted to do so. I don't know if it's time for Luke Grohmann to finally be proven right, but it seems like this dollar move is gone further than I expected it to.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because we're down almost $4 a barrel today on that break, and that's pretty much the biggest down day we've seen in crude oil since the bloodbath days of March and April. Is this, in your mind, a major reversal in oil?
Well, you know, I think the jury is still out on that. I would have thought so, because I and a lot of other people have been saying, look, this rally has gotten way ahead of the fundamentals. It's too much too fast. We're overdue for a pullback. And I definitely still believe that. I think there's plenty of reason for a reasonable person to think, hey, the market's overdone. Let's expect maybe a pullback to $25 or so on WTI next. Now, I'm not going to hold my breath waiting for that to happen, Patrick, because at every turn during this rally, every time I thought the market was starting to roll over, it turned out it was just consolidating for a couple of days, and then it went even higher. And I've been very surprised by how much strength there has been in the market. So are we really going to get a big, substantial pullback? Yeah, it seems like we got the ingredients. Today, we closed both on the crudes and on the finished products below the short-term moving averages, below the 5, 8, and 13-day moving averages. That usually is a sign that a new downtrend has begun. So we've got all the technical indications that the market's rolling over. Question is, rolling over for how far? Or are we going to be surprised and have the pullback be just a tiny little pullback? One thing that I do note is we didn't yet fill in that gap that's at about 41.05. on the continuation chart, 41.88 on the contract chart for WTI. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we just had another one of these mini pullbacks, turns out to be smaller than everybody thought, and we end up filling that gap first and then moving down into a more meaningful pullback. I really don't know what to expect next. Let's watch the tape and see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because it's still in the middle of its trade range, more or less always heading down toward the bottom end, towards 1700, then working its way back to 1750. No major breakout and certainly no major reaction today to the bigger intermarket moves that we're seeing in all the other asset classes. What's your bias here on bullion?
Well, as you say, we're still in that trading range. It's not like we've seen some major new bullish signal, but you know, every time that we seem to test 1700, and I think perhaps just wishful thinking, because I'd love to see a big technical correction so I could buy some gold on the cheap or add to my gold position on the cheap, I should say. It seems like we're just really rejecting 1700. A pretty strong base is starting to form there. And as technicians sometimes say, the longer the base, the higher in space. I think Luis Yamada used to say that. So as much as I have been saying for months and months now, we're overdue for a technical correction. That overdue or overbought condition, it normally resolves itself with a technical correction, but it can also be resolved by just a consolidation that lasts for a while and puts in a strong base. Starting to feel more and more to me like maybe 1700, seems like actually it's around 1680 or so on an intraday basis. It's just the number we can't get through. If we saw a daily close below the 100-day moving average, which is 1661 right now, that would cause me to finally, with some excitement, say, okay, the move to the downside that I've been looking forward to is finally upon us. But so far, it seems like 1700 has been a really solid base. So if that continues, and particularly if we get a daily close north of 1780, that would really start to sell the bullish story. So I'm starting to think more and more that correction I've been hoping for might not be coming after all.
All right, and let's finish off with that 10-year Treasury yield. What a pop and drop that was. I mean, it looked like last week that this was a major breakout and some massive inflation was going to start being discounted into that yield. And here we are just, you know, four trading sessions later, and we're back down to under 70 basis points again. Just complete fake out on that move. I mean, do you have any take on what's going on here in your mind?
Well, of course, it's been coincident with both the FOMC meeting and the change in direction for both the stock market and crude oil. So it seems like somehow between the FOMC statement, the economic outlook that the Fed published, and this newfound people waking up finally to what should have been obvious for weeks, which is a second wave of the coronavirus crisis is coming. It seems like that's some risk off, and of course, that tends to support buying of bonds and lower bond yields. So it makes sense. I really don't have any opinion, Patrick, on the short-term direction of treasuries. What I'm really concerned about is, are we seeing a bottoming process here just above zero yield, or are we eventually going to get to negative yields? And that's what I'm going to ask all of our feature interview guests, including Diego Padilla today.
This week's feature interview guest is Diego Padilla. Now, why did we invite Diego back as this week's guest?
Well, Patrick, Diego Padilla is a really strong macro guy. He's also, we didn't get into it that much in this interview, but he's also a very, very strong options guy, which I know is near and dear to your heart. I wanted to get him back because with everything going on in the market, okay, are we seeing a secular shift from deflation to inflation or stagflation? Are we seeing a bottoming of treasury yields? These are the kind of macro questions that I'm focused on these days, and I'm looking for guests who I think are going to be really strong in those areas. And same reason we had Daniel Lacalle back on recently. Diego Padilla is a really strong guy in that regard. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Diego is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Diego Padilla, portfolio manager for Quadriga Asset Management and best-selling author of two books, both The Energy World is Flat, which he co-wrote with Daniel Lacalle, another very popular Macro Voices guest, and another book which we talked about in Diego's last interview called The Anti-Bubbles. Diego, it's great to have you back. Needless to say, what's on everybody's mind is holy cow, look at the stock market. It seems like there's a lot of good arguments being made that we've still got a global pandemic. It's not over. There's riots breaking out in the streets. There's a lot of, you know, stuff going on. But boy, the market tape-wise just couldn't look stronger. What do you make of all this, and how should investors think about it?
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation. It's great to be back. I think there are really three major tectonic forces that are driving global macro. And to a certain extent, they're pushing and pulling in different directions. The first one is the fact that the damage was already done. So this is the idea that a decade of effectively artificially low interest rates, monetary policy without limits, had transformed, you know, the investment framework from what I would say the transformation of risk-free interest into interest-free risk. You have something like the bond, 10-year bonds going from 5% in the 10-year to 30-year negative nominal yields. this is effectively creating a total distortion of asset prices, effectively driven by mainly artificial low interest rates. But you know, we discussed this at length with the belief in the central bank put, the complacent, desperate search for yield, and how that has created a series of global synchronous bubbles without precedence. Then the second key thing is we are suddenly hit by a shock without precedence. It's been a shock in multiple dimensions. It's been a volatility shock where the VIX went, you know, close to 90. I mean, levels we haven't really seen since 2008. It's been obviously a demand shock with things like oil going into negative oil prices and massive destruction of jobs and the economy. You have obviously a supply shock with logistical chains. You have a healthcare shock. You have a political shock. You have lots of things. And this is obviously making things even worse. But then you have the third force, which is effectively a monetary and fiscal response without precedent, both in terms of the size, which has been is dwarfed in a way, 2008, the speed at which it happens, you know, just within a few days or weeks, we have the mobilization, again, way notably than 08. In terms of scope, so the Fed going and basically buying beyond government bonds, going all the way to high yield. And also, hugely importantly, fiscally, which is something that, you know, had been planned for. You look at Europe, the transition at the central bank was already realizing the fact that, you know, monetary policy might be approaching its limits and how we would need to combine this fiscally. So we've seen the recovery fund, we've seen all sorts of MMT with checks, you know, given to people, increasing spending, increasing debt. And we cannot underestimate the impact of this third force in multiple ways. I mean, first of all, obviously, cutting the tail risk associated with the utter collapse. I mean, it's only a few weeks ago that lots of people were calling for a depression, like in the 30s, and suddenly it's all, you know, looking at historical highs. It's just extraordinarily brutal how things have moved. But also, you know, quantitatively, I mean, once, you know, you remove this tail, the narrative of the market, the central bank put and the squeeze of lots of shorts has obviously contributed. And what we're seeing now also is signals being triggered. You know, you have volatility coming off from high levels to around 25%. You see very strong trends that and you see arguably some FOMO, but more importantly, my view, also a lot of quantitative buying, which be careful with that, because I think we've seen this movie a few times already. I mean, we saw going into the end of 2018, how, you know, trend followers were max long at the top in leverage form, only to effectively be taken out it was a sharp move, increasing volatility and collapsing prices, which effectively forced them to liquidate, only to buy it back all the way through 2019, only to be taken out again in 2020. And it's almost like, you know, this roller coaster is almost Darwinistically looking to take out all this massive increase of day traders and things that you might be fooled by this short-term dynamic. So I think that from a bigger perspective, this is not a healthy situation. The damage has been done. The current shock is to be, you know, assessed, and really how much permanent damage versus temporary. But what we know with some degree of certainty is that, you know, perhaps the virus will go hopefully soon and things will improve. But a lot of this liquidity will stay. And I think this has been a dominant feature in the markets, where central banks and governments use this opportunities, this crisis, to introduce dramatic measures, and then they take years to, if anything, to unwind them, and they become permanent. So we've seen that dynamic happen after 2008, and that's why perhaps, you know, we have distorted even more what was already a highly distorted picture. So it's really, you know, I think this shock has an extra level of complexity, which is the transformation of the world we live in. I mean, there are some businesses, that are experiencing challenges like never before, and they're probably done by now, and there's other opportunities. So I think this shaking up of the world, considering where we started, the dimension of the shock and the sort of responses, creates a highly uncertain world, but certainly, in my view, highly distorted.
Let's talk about the U.S. dollar next. Those of us who thought that there was going to be an upside resolution for the U.S. dollar because of the extra flight capital moving into the safer currency and so forth, we've been surprised. We broke out of a trading range where we were really consolidating above 99 for about 6 months. And just in the last couple of weeks, it's broken down to below 97, most of that owing to a move on the euro. What do you make of the dollar? What comes next?
Look, currencies, at the end of the day, is a relative game. It's very hard to call, you know, just directionally one thing. It's all relative. If I print $1 trillion and you print $1 trillion, then we're flat, right? So here, what we're seeing with the dollar is, I don't think the U.S. could be trying any harder to devalue the dollar. I mean, they are benefiting from the beauty of the status quo of being reserve currency and the large benefits associated with that. Not only seigniorage as a central bank who can print its own currency, but also with lots of people parking their money with you on the belief that you won't do crazy stuff. And I think, you know, if you think about what's happening and the response, you know, it's a clear exercise when you start bailing airlines and energy companies and whatever it takes, and you do that with money that is being effectively printed and lent, what's your downside? I mean, you're the central bank, and the minute central bank independence is gone, you know, what's your downside? I will do this in whatever it takes fashion, and Powell has clearly said that. Your downside is obviously, you know, some kind of lack of credibility, some sort of inflation and some sort of devaluation, which arguably is something the U.S. wants. I mean, behind the global monetary policy, which is sold and presented as domestic, doing what is good for your own country, there's always been a big factor that is international, is the exchange rate. And the proof, you know, if you think about why we've had negative interest rates in Europe, it's pretty simple. The only reason we have negative interest rates in Europe is because the Federal Reserve in the U.S. was at zero. And we needed to have a negative interest rate differential to devalue the euro in defense, by the way, to the attack of post-2008. So ultimately, the dynamics with the currencies and the monetary and fiscal policies without limits are leading to competitive devaluations, yes or yes. And this, in turn, is also leading to inflation dynamics. Whether you see them or not, and how they manifest on through the exchange rate, and you know how much is Europe printing, both in absolute and relative terms to the dollar, you could argue that Europe is actually printing even faster than the US. And in that sense, I don't really see this currency race. I use it, the analogy of a long term race, like a marathon, right? In the short term, honestly, we're talking weeks or months, who knows? It's complete noise to some extent. But over a longer term, you know, I think that in this currency war, it's pretty clear to me who will win, and that will be gold. And it's pretty clear to me who will lose, which are, you know, currencies that are printing and that are, have a lot of hidden leverage and lots of internal bubbles and inflation, such as China, not just the usual suspects being Brazil or you know, South Africa or others. So in the middle, when you look at the dollar and the euro and the yen and the Swiss franc and sterling, I think the dollar will come strong because of some of these shortage and global dynamics. But against that, you can see that the U.S. is really doing whatever it takes to try to devalue. In my view, you can read between the lines what's happening and how they're expressing that they have infinite tools, and they will use them. So that's really, once again, it's bringing us to the topic of inflation.
Diego, I couldn't agree more with what you just said about gold being the ultimate winner in this race to the bottom between the currencies. But, you know, as we're speaking on Monday, we recorded this a few days early this week, gold is back down to retesting levels not seen since early April. Almost looks like we're seeing the beginning of a technical correction to the downside. Does that just mean this is a big buying opportunity here? Or is it maybe the case that we've got some down before the big up move happens?
Look, I don't have a crystal ball, and I tend to look at these moves with a medium to long-term perspective. I'm on the record thinking that gold might be 3,000 to 5,000 in the next 3 to 5 years. So with that mindset, you know, $20, $30 correction is just noise, right? Clearly, the market has been, you know, what we've seen is not just gold. I mean, you've seen quite a few other tail sort of or hedges that people might have in the portfolios against potentially the you know, a risk off scenario. So you see them moving in dollar yen or the Swiss franc or even treasuries, of course, gold or the VIX. They're all kind of telling you the same story. And I think that the move we're seeing is more of a, you know, some relaxation of the tail and some hedges being taken off and perhaps some shorts or some people being squeezed out. But I certainly don't think that this is over. And when you look at these different assets I discussed, I think, yes, this could be an opportunity to add or to rebalance the portfolio. And, you know, every time we talk about adding you need some dry power, right? So you need to be have some money on the sidelines. But I think this is, to me, is more about, you know, rebalancing portfolios. You have to have both, as I call it, strikers and defenders. And when you have these portfolio dynamics, when equities perhaps are overshooting on the upside or oil might be shooting on the upside in the short term or others, when you have a more balanced portfolio and you have the ability to take, you know, some of those out and add some of the defenders in, just like you would do the same situation when the market goes the other way. So when equities collapse and some of these, you know, hedges or safe havens do very well, you can basically take some profit on that. So I take this view that you can't fight the stupidity of the market. You cannot fight the quote unquote irrationality of the market. And what we've always done is we try to embrace that volatility, that stupidity, that irrationality. And in order to do that, you need to have team. You know, you need to have the different pieces. If you are just positioned one way, then this is potentially very painful. If you are leveraged, then you're dead. And so I think that this short-term volatility dynamics are noise, but there's lots of people who base their entire trading strategies on technicals and things that for me would be noise. But yeah, it's they're probably very good at that, and maybe they're very successful. But it's not something that we look at. So for us, these are, again, big moves, structural. We play through options. We take advantage of these moves through in multiple ways. And certainly, as these moves increase, then we like to add. And this happens through rebalancing.
You mentioned crude oil a moment ago. Let's touch on that. Saudi Arabia kind of surprised the market this past weekend when they raised prices on exports of oil to Asia by the largest amount, I think, on record ever, about a $6 increase that most people didn't see coming. And even before that happened, I've been really surprised by the strength of this rally. Something I noticed about crude oil on the way down was, well, the stock market could be held up by Fed speak and so forth. You know, crude oil couldn't be immune to the realities of supply and demand in the physical marketplace. It seems like on the way back up, it feels to me like it's gotten ahead of itself. Is that just me being pessimistic, or what do you make of the very rapid V-shaped recovery that we've seen so far in oil prices?
I would agree with you. I think, you know, if you think about anticipatory assets such as equities that might be discounting, you know, the long-term picture versus, you know, the front-end oil, they're obviously very different. And it's clear and it surprised everybody. I mean, when you think about the severity of of the demand destruction, the increase in inventories during that time, and the delayed response of OPEC and probably insufficient at the time. I mean, it really took quite a bit to reverse this, and you know, you have second order effects like, you know, China and potentially people don't want to go on the transport public and they want to go in their own car. So it suddenly has this incredible pickup in gasoline whilst diesel or kerosene are still obviously very subdued. So the OPEC dynamics, you know, there are limits to what they can do. And certainly they have to do something, yes or yes, because with that level of oversupply, then once you get to tank tops, it's game over, right? But I think that issue is still there. I mean, we have a roughly billion barrels of inventory overhang to deal with. And it's not like, you know, suddenly the demand, you know, surprises on the upside and the market is balanced, that everything's over. You still have massive inventory to work through. So, you know, you have to, I think it's something that, again, it's, the danger is still there. The danger is much more on the on the tank tops, let's say, that the other way. There are multiple risks, in my view, ahead. And I would agree with you that perhaps, you know, the momentum and the move, again, going back to not only physical guys, but also the financial flows, which might be taking place in the front and spreads and stuff, have been contributing. So I think the general view is, you know, the market is almost pricing a perfect recovery right now, at least in the near term. And perhaps short term, the risk might be skewed to lower prices. Not a collapse, but, you know, I think mid-30s probably makes sense from the sort of low 40s where we're now. Medium, long term, I think the challenges will be to balance back that inventory situation and to what extent the demand recovery is for real and what damage has been done also on the supply side. But I guess the consensus is probably, you know, more constructive there, where, you know, probably $45-$50 is a reasonable target medium longer term. The problem, as you know, for retail investors, and I think this has been the real shame in these moves, is how painful can the contango be for retail investors who are buying the ETF, right? And it's part of the learning, I guess. But you know, you're not just buying the price. Oh, I want to buy oil at negative prices. Great, let's buy your size. Yeah, it's not as simple as that. And so I think there's a bit of there's some challenges there in terms of implementation. And again, I think if you combine that view that short term, perhaps things are a bit overdone, with I think the associated contango and negative carry, with a long term view that is more constructive, it's not that easy to play. But I would think short-term cautious, medium, long-term more constructive, but mind the carry, because it can eat away capital and create permanent loss of capital, as you know.
Diego, you mentioned inflation a few minutes ago. I want to come back to that. A theme that we've seen with a lot of our expert guests is, with differing time horizons, they see maybe a shift from the disinflation to deflationary macro backdrop of the last decade toward either stagflation or inflation. So I guess my first question is, do you agree in general with that view? If so, is it inflation or stagflation? And perhaps a hardest question, how long does it take and what does it look like? What's the process look like to get from here to there?
Well, I would say stagflation. And I think it's, timing is unknown, but I think it's important to understand, you know, lots of people look at the dynamics and they say, well, you know, you have massive unemployment, you have technology, you have demographics, you have overcapacity, we have the bubbles. These are all very deflationary forces. I mean, at the end of the day, the way I think about this is, look, the more deflation you have, the more room you're giving central banks to print even more without effectively showing. So it's almost like a freebie that they have. But let's not fool ourselves. Inflation is 100% a monetary phenomenon. And the way I explain this is it's not really about the price of your house going up. It's not really about the price of bread going up. That's not inflation. Inflation is about the value of the money that you use to buy that bread or that house going down. And if you think about the sheer amount of printing out of nowhere, out of thin air, or you know, not, it's not even paper anymore, out of you know, zeros and ones and digits and bits, this is just I think unavoidable. And if you think about it, it's probably is the end game of a decade where you've been literally just distorting valuations and keeping creating bubbles through excessive monetary and fiscal. So there's no other real way out, I think, than inflation. And this is what central banks want. This is, you know, the way to get your way out of the excessive debt. It's obviously a big problem for cash. It's a big problem for many things. And, you know, I call it, the problem is what I call the frog in boiling water, right? We are being diluted at, you know, the target officially is 2%, right? So you would argue 2% is I think scientifically calculated so that it's small enough that we frogs in the monetary pot are staying because it doesn't look that bad. But if you actually stay in this for 10 years, you're going to get 20% compounded. And if you're in this for 20 years, you're looking at closer to 50%. So once you see that over that horizon, your money has been stolen really through inflation, then you see that. So right now it's even worse. We are outright negative rates. You have very deeply potentially negative real rates. So beyond the naivety of savers who don't see that inflation because the goalpost has been moved and all the other forces, I think this is happening. Perhaps, you know, phase one and the Gresham's law is obviously much slower. You're looking at dynamics where it's not so obvious, but anybody that has experienced inflation, you know, lots of listeners maybe in Latin America or other places know that once you go into a phase two where inflation expectations kick in, then the process accelerates massively. To what extent, you know, is this likely to happen in the near term and what are the catalysts is harder to play out. But I think more importantly, it has created a change in the rules of the game. Okay. We used to think, and this is pretty much since fiat currencies were introduced, this is a game where central banks were effectively given the keys of the printing press. And where the independence of the central bank was, you know, at the forefront. And as Voltaire would have told us, you know, paper currencies eventually revert to their intrinsic value. That is paper. So in this dynamic where we are faced with non-independent central banks and where inflation, i.e. the fact that they would abuse that printing press because the government, which, you know, controls them, forces them to do that, I think that's the conventional rules of the game. So if you thought about, oh, inflation is going to be the problem, therefore they're going to hike interest rates, therefore, you know, bonds are going to go down, I think you would be missing the new dynamics, because my feeling is that the bubbles we've created are so huge, they're effectively too big to fail. And this is the new enemy. So it's no longer about inflation. It's really about the bubbles. So the reason we will have potentially a lot of inflation, people might think hiking rates are coming. It's not going to happen because if you hike rates, then it's pretty much game over. I mean, if you hike rates, not just the zombies, it's just the entire system, I think, and the bubbles would collapse. It's not just bonds. It's the entire thing, this construct with zero negative rates. So the rules of the game have changed, and we need to acknowledge that and know that, in my view, we're likely to go to a world with zero interest rates and inflation. And effectively, monetary policy and fiscal do not solve problems. Okay, no matter what central banks will tell us, they can prevent and the utter collapse of the system occasionally. But if you don't remove these things and you just keep abusing them, they're not really solving any problems. They're just delaying, transferring the problem in form of currency wars, transforming the problem in the form of inflation, and eventually enlarging the problem. So I think inflation is at the forefront of the next 10 years. And just like I summarized the previous 10 years as the transformation of risk-free interest into interest-free risk, I think the next 10 years is the transformation of bubbles that are too big to fail into inflation, or more likely, stagflation.
Diego, I want to take all of these macro concepts and tie them together into actual portfolio construction concepts, because that's what matters the most to investors at the end of the day. You and I talked off the air about what some people have termed false diversification, the idea that the old rules of diversification don't quite apply the same way because some of the dynamics of some of those asset classes have changed. Please expound on that. What are we talking about, and why is this important to understand?
Yeah, it's hugely important. I call false diversification, you know, confusing two simple things. One is my portfolio has a lot of things. So I have a bit of oil, I have a bit of Argentinian bonds, I have some Amazon, I have some whatever, government bonds. And you have a lot of things and you think you're diversified, you know, the conventional asset class diversification. The reality is that when these crises have come, many of these assets, if not all, have actually behaved just the same way. So correlations actually polarize, and you go from a portfolio that looks diversified and assets that are uncorrelated to everything collapsing at the same time. So the false diversification is the risk by which investors think they were diversified, and the reality is they were not. And this can actually result, unfortunately, in some way as a hidden leverage. You know, it's happened to many retail investors, but it's also happened to the most experienced investors. I mean, take Ray Dalio and his risk parity, right? I mean, look, I have bonds and equities and they're negatively correlated, and therefore I can lever my exposure and I'm always hedged. And the reality is in March, both were collapsing in ways the models were not predicting. Volatility explodes, correlations break, and bang, he gets, you know, alongside with many other people, completely, you know, under a lot of pressure. So what you need, and this is something that is not easy to achieve, but is what we specialize on, is really you need to find assets that are not just negatively correlated on paper. You need things that behave in a given way. And, you know, this leads me to this eternal debate between bulls and bears. I mean, if you're in Twitter, you just see all day, hey, you know, I thought the dollar bulls, the bear bulls, and everybody's, I'm right, you're right. And no, this is going up, this is going. And it's just the whole day, you know, fighting over, you know, who's right or who's wrong. And to me, this is, it's kind of going back to my point earlier. I think to me, this is not about being correct or being a bull or being a bear. It's about having the right team. I mean, you want to have the best bulls in your team and effectively your strikers in the team. You want them to score you goals. I mean, the market goes up. You want to make sure that you have parts in the portfolio that will score goals. Yes or yes or yes. And that's their role. Your role is to score goals. Of course, you know, we need to balance out the downside risk when things go wrong. So in an ideal world, your strikers are call options. You want to buy a call option on S&P or whatever. But the other side is, you know, you also want to have, you know, strong bears, right? I mean, you want to have guys that when things go really wrong, no matter how unpredicted or surprised, they will do very well. And you know, these are things like options, you know, S&P puts, you could have VIX or calls on the VIX or gold or different ways that combine. And this is really what we specialize on. I mean, we designed our strategy, Igneo, which I believe was the best hedge fund in the world in February with plus 10 and was one of the best throughout the crisis. We were 19.1% in March. And currently, and we also made money in April and May, by the way. So strategy, you know, you need to find ways in which you create that correlation of minus one when you need it. And so when you build these teams of strikers and goalkeepers and you can rebalance them, I think it's actually really powerful and you are embracing that irrationality, that volatility. And I would take my point farther. I would say that there's lots of strategies that are being sold or missold as one thing. And the capital sin in the industry, in my view, is to say that you will do one thing and you will do something else. And in that sense, you know, a lot of the trend following strategies arguably have been sold as correlated and diversifiers, when in reality and by construction, you don't need to be a genius to realize that the CTAs are long the market at the top when the trend is strong and the volatility is low. So they're max long leveraged. So that's not really, you cannot be a defender, in my view, when you're max long equities, for example, at the top. So in that sense, the false diversification is critical to understand, you know, potentially accidents. And most importantly, it can, and most dangerously, it can lead to hidden leverage. Look, if you were buying a leverage ETF 3-to-1, you went in with your eyes wide open. You knew that if the market's down, you know, 20-30%, you're most likely completely wiped out, because at that point, your $100 are 10 cents. And it's just literally impossible that you will ever make your way up. So they're very dangerous, but it's something you do with your eyes open. But very often, these highly leveraged positions, you know, people are not quite aware that they have them. And this is where it's not just about the volatility of the individual players, which can explode. It's also about the correlation between the assets. And I think this is something that, again, we are spending a lot of time educating investors in first of all, avoiding these big drawdowns and these risks, you know, avoiding the leverage and trying to find ways in which those teams will be more balanced. Because then, again, you can embrace the volatility of the market. And in that sense, you know, this is what we set up to do. The universe of strategies out there, probably the ratio of strikers to goalkeepers is 999-1. And it's just quite easy to find long onlys and ETFs and long bias and everything else. It's in this environment, it's a lot harder to find good goalkeepers and defenders. But I would argue that the next 10 years or whatever, this is the dynamics, it's much more about finding that balance in the team than just pretending that this is just going to be like the last 10 years, just buy the dip and this is it. I think we're in a very different scenario. And I think, to paraphrase, I think Howard Marks from Oaktree, one of his recent newsletters, and I got this forwarded by one investor of ours, because he was like, look, Diego, someone seems to be, you know, converting to your thinking, or at least expressing it. And he put it very nicely. He said, listen, I've spent the last few decades, you know, trying to effectively optimize between large cap, small cap, developed market versus emerging market, you know, value versus growth, whatever, EM, DM, all these things, right? And equity versus credit. And the reality is that you're just optimizing your strikers. They're all strikers. They're all the same thing. And so, you know, he said, this, I realized that this is more about, you know, balancing the offense and defense. And I think that, again, this is much more important to find the right defense and offense balance than just optimizing your strikers. Because without defense, I think this match is going to be very, very tricky.
Diego, let's expand on this theme that we're discussing of false diversification. And particularly, there's a theory that's been bouncing around, which is so much faith has been placed in the risk parity strategy, where a lot of institutional investors are long equities and leveraged long bonds, on the idea that bonds and equities always have inverse correlation. If that correlation were to reverse so that bonds and equities started selling off at the same time, it would force a major institutional unwind of what's probably the most popular strategy in all of institutional finance. Is that just a conspiracy theory, or is that a realistic scenario? And if the latter, how realistic is it? How big is the risk?
Well, it's pretty real, but even before we get into correlations, when you look at the track record of these strategies, and you know, let's think about both parts of the trade, right? Your equities right now, you're looking at, let's say, the S&P around 3,200. You know, how balanced are the risks? Who knows? But certainly, you could have very significant downside. It's not inconceivable that you could have a 10, 20, 30% downside, right? On the other hand, when you think about your bonds, right, and your treasuries, and you're looking at yields in the 10-year treasury at, you know, call it 60, 70 basis points, if yields went to zero, your best case scenario is you will be making 6-7%, right? So the first order of the problem is that these conventional 60-40 balance portfolios, or by the sister strategy, risk parity, which actually levers those components because of this, it's in a way an extrapolation of dynamics that are assuming that if equities went down by 30%, you know, in order to get your 30% basically coverage, you would be looking at deeply negative interest rates, right, from current levels. This is even worse in Europe, right, because we're already in negative rates. Plus, in some cases, many of these issuers have significant credit risk. So, you know, Spanish government bonds or Italian bonds or whatever at negative yields is just remarkable, if not insane, but is the proof. So the first point I would make is be careful with extrapolating historical returns, because the distortion of monetary policy through artificially low interest rates or negative interest rates is creating a very asymmetric profile where you have a lot of downside on the equities, arguably, and not that much upside. So in that sense, I tend to describe the German Bund, the government bond, as Franz Beckenbauer. And for those who follow soccer, he was this legendary German defender, you know, who was fantastic. And they won the World Cup in 1974. But he's now 74 years old. Okay, so yes, he used to be a great defender. He's actually, you know, not as fast as in his ability to defend. The second point you make is on correlations breaking up. And I think this is something that we've experienced very clearly and in a very meaningful way during March. And it's important to understand, a bit like in real life, in nature, if any of the listeners have studied fluid mechanics, for example, you know, you have a very stable sort of laminar regime where things are linear and predictable. And then at one point, things go turbulent. And then, boom, things behave in a different way. This is nature, right? The markets are a bit the same. You know, you have laminar regime, and then you have turbulent regime. And when you go into turbulent regime and volatilities explode, you start a mechanical process that is unstoppable. I mean, if you have your value at risk, your VAR, you know, both through implied and realized volatility, right? As volatility increases, your value at risk increases, and you're forced to cut. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you are a day trader and you're taken out in 3 seconds because the market's moving like 5% up and down every day, or whether you are a hedge fund whose value at risk has tripled and your force asks you to cut. You have effectively forced liquidation. As you start having forced liquidation because volatility goes up, then you start to see that everybody has the same trades, and then correlations start to increase. And when volatilities increase and correlations increase, then the value at risk increases geometrically or exponentially. And this creates an even bigger wave of forced liquidation, which effectively starts potentially impacting liquidity. So, you know, good luck selling those high yield bonds in the middle of a crisis, right? And then these things, boom. Even treasuries gapped. I mean, it's just hard to believe. So this is not, it's something that is actually very predictable and is very mechanical. So in that sense, the correlation breaks that you're discussing is something that could be triggered by many things. I mean, right now it's like, oh my God, now fine. Yeah, of course, we're, you know, pandemic under control. Who knows? I mean, you could have massive escalation of tensions with China. You could have, you know, hundreds of things that could happen that could trigger another wave of forced liquidation and correlations and stuff. And if you think about the size and the leverage of these positions, they actually feed on themselves. So once again, I don't think you can, I mean, you can count the beans and try to see at what point level things start to unwind and what's the pain threshold. And we saw that in March. I'm sure that, you know, adjustments have been made. So things will not happen exactly the same way. But it's naive to think that we got it all figured out and this is not going to happen again, because it's just going to happen again. And the more complacency we have about the fact that it will not happen again and that I should have bought the dip, then the bigger it gets. And I do have that feeling that we haven't really solved things. These things are actually compounding and getting larger and larger. So we'll see. But the size is very meaningful. I mean, it's huge exposures that, are subject to this arguably hidden risk and leverage. So yeah, time will tell, but I think it's we're bound to repeat them again. But obviously, I don't have a crystal ball for when, but mind those hidden risks.
Diego, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Again, for our listeners' benefit, the titles of Diego's books are The Energy World is Flat, co-authored with our good friend Daniel Lacalle, and The Anti-Bubbles. And there was a discussion about The Anti-Bubbles on my last interview with Diego. So if you want to learn more about that, just put Diego's name into the search box at macrovoices.com. Diego, before we let you go, please tell our listeners your Twitter handle and how they can follow your work.
Yeah, my Twitter is at Parrilla Diego, P-A-R-R-I-L-L-A Diego, D-I-E-G-O. And you can DM me if anybody's interested in following the views or also getting more information about the strategies that we run. Please DM me or send me an email. It's diego.parrilla@quadriga.es.
Okay, we look forward to getting you back in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Diego back on the show. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, I always enjoy talking to Diego. And, you know, the striking thing to me, it's not just this interview, but it's all of the smartest guys that we interview. They all have their own little, you know, quirks and opinions. But everybody is saying the same major themes, which is there's going to be more debasement of fiat currency. Precious metals are going to be the place to be. We're probably going to see a secular shift from deflation to inflation or stagflation. Those are the really big themes, and Diego is echoing the same things that a lot of the other experts we have on the show are saying. Now, as we discussed off the air, Patrick, I forgot that Diego is also a big options guy. Listeners, Patrick was ready to strangle me for not asking Diego about what's going on with the market in terms of the gamma trade and so forth. So what we're going to do in this post-game segment is we're going to make up for my failure to ask Diego those things, and Patrick is going to walk us through a presentation he's calling Long Gamma on the Wings. This is a great chart deck. I strongly recommend that you download it. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, before we get into the ratio backspread strategies that you're describing starting on page two, let's start with the title, Long Gamma on the Wings. Refresh our memory in terms of both what gamma is, but particularly on the wings. What are we talking about here?
Right. And so whether it's someone like Diego or Chris Cole, they talk about these strategies of being long the gamma or being long the volatility on big trend moves in the markets. And one of the things that you can always just go long gamma with just buying calls and puts, but they come at the expense of a very large carry cost as the time decay erodes your position quite rapidly if the trade isn't worth working in your favor immediately. And so the question and the thing that option strategists always look for is, how can I implement an options trade where I reduce the cost of carry and yet at the same time position something in my portfolio that if one of these really big moves happens in the markets, I have the ability to capture the gain or hedge my portfolio with one of these strategies. And so one of the strategies we've talked about it during our sessions out right after Chris Cole's interviews as well, was the idea of doing ratio spreads, or also known as back spreads. And I thought it was a great opportunity for us to revisit this, because with the way that the market has made this extraordinary move, whether it's in equities or in oil or in bonds, we've seen these massive moves. And there is always the potential for really big moves to still play out from here, whether higher or lower. And so the question is, how do you position for a big tail move? This idea that it's going to be a 2, 3, 4 sigma move potentially. And if you're wrong, how do you make sure that the carry cost of the trade was very low? And so this is where I want to talk about this ratio backspread. And backspreads are this idea of selling an at-the-money option, which always has the largest premium. And then you use the proceeds of this large premium that you've been credited to buy a larger amount of out-of-the-money options. The typical way, and the way we'll talk about it here, is 2-to-1 ratio, but there is no limit to amount. There's some people that will open up, 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 ratios going farther out of the money. But for simplicity, we're just going to do today a 2-to-1 ratio where we sell an at-the-money option, buy 2 out-of-the-money options. And the goal in this situation, or often the goal, is to open the trade as close as possible to zero cost, where the debit or credit is very close to zero. Now, when I say that, it does, just because it's zero cost doesn't mean there isn't a margin to carry the position, because it's still a spread. But by opening it very close to a zero cost, you don't have this big theta burn that is occurring. And so rather, there's a whole other dynamic of the way the trade develops.
Okay, now let me see if I got this straight, Patrick. So if I'm looking at the S&P today, I would love to buy puts. In other words, I want to bet on the possibility that maybe good old-fashioned economics are actually going to come back and start working like the good old days again. And because of the fact that we literally have riots in the streets and a second wave of a pandemic coming and a lot of economic difficulty that is not priced into the market, I want a profit, I want a windfall profit from the crash, if the crash comes. But Patrick, I can't justify buying a bunch of puts in this environment because the VIX is really high right now. Those puts are expensive. You're telling me there's a way for me to make that trade where if there's a crash, I'm going to have the windfall profit. But if the market just goes down a little bit, or even if the market goes up, I don't end up losing my premium the way that I normally would. How's that possible?
Well, there are other risks, and that's why we're going to talk about those. But particularly, I mean, you're talking about the S&P 500, and often I do like to put it on the S&P, but the S&P particularly has a fat left tail that basically means that you have to widen your strikes considerably to make it at zero cost. So at least in this environment, the S&P is not the most perfect place to be putting on the backspread. But I do want to talk about where I think there are some really interesting ways to implement some of the intermarket relationships of a market crash. Things like, for instance, typically yields decline and bonds rise during a period of risk off. And at the same time, typically oil also weakens in that environment. And so I wanted to cherry pick a couple of the other assets to kind of put on some of these spreads and give an example of what this would look like. And so let's jump into it. I first wanted to start with a call back spread. And I wanted to put that onto bonds. And the reason I thought this was a fascinating place to start was because we've had so many guests on the show having this big debate as to whether or not inflation or stagflation or deflation is the dominant force. And it's truly a polarized topic. And it really can have both extremes, where we have this huge collapse in yields, but at the same time, in the right conditions, yields can skyrocket. And so I really feel that putting on these ratio backspreads on bonds is a really fascinating place to do it, because in this example, we're going to use the TLT, which is a treasury bond ETF. But if we truly do have a another leg of a bear market coming, it is entirely possible that the 30-year bond yield breaks to a lower low and we're under 1%, as even no matter how much that seems unbelievable, it's just amazing what bonds and interest rates have been doing in this environment. And at the same time, I want to have a way that it's not going to burn us if suddenly yields go skyrocketing. So the idea here is that, well, if yields drop below 1% on the longest end of the curve, that in that circumstance, the TLT is entirely can head to $180 a share on the upside. And so how do we put on one of these call back spreads to buy some of the upside of the right tail of this big move on bonds that can happen? But yet, if bonds never move, it didn't cost us a lot of money to have this trade on. And so on page 6 of the chart deck, we have the October option series. And I wanted to particularly focus on the $160 and $170 strikes on the TLT. So the TLT at the time of this example, like we look at on the chart, was at $163. So we're actually going slightly in the money on the short call. And so what we're doing is for you can do this in a 2-to-1 ratio, but you sell the 160 call, which gives you a credit of $7.80 or $780 for every one contract. And we use the proceeds of that to buy two call options at the $170 strikes, $10 higher than the 160 strike. Those were asking $3.70 or would cost a $740 debit to buy two of those call options. So we're doing this 2-to-1 ratio, and we're doing this literally for almost zero cost. It's a $40 credit for us to have this trade on. And what this does is it creates a payoff profile chart that shows on chart 7, which is this idea that, well, if the TLT goes crashing lower and we were, let's say we were dead wrong and the TLT heads to 150, 140, it doesn't matter that both legs of the options expire and you're left with a $40 credit. At the same time, if yields just keep nosediving and we're south of 1%, you can see is on this chart, the right side of the chart has all this 45-degree angle higher where you have all of the upside of the TLT north of 170. And really, the only place that the loss occurs is if we have the treasury bonds rise and yields just slightly go down and then stay there between now and October. And so this is a really interesting way of implementing this bond view that either one of the two extremes is going to happen. Either A, yields are going to go skyrocketing higher and I'll lose nothing, or two, yields are going to go nosediving and I'm going to make a pile of money. And the only scenario where the loss is occurring is if yields just slightly go down and stay there.
Okay, Patrick, so in this trade, we're basically doing something similar to going long on bonds, expecting that we're going to see lower yields and we're going to make money from the long side of bonds, but we're protected so that if that situation goes the other way, where you see a backing up of yields because inflation expectations suddenly start to ratchet up, and boy, you know, it's taken the last 10 years at least of people waiting for inflation expectations to come back into the game. Hasn't happened yet. Probably won't happen between now and October. But if it did, and you were outright long those bonds, you could really get taken to the cleaner. So this way, you're protecting your downside, but you've still got an asymmetric opportunity for a much larger participation on the profit side of the trade if things go your way. Now, let's turn this all around. This was a callback spread. What about a putback spread? How would that work?
Right. And this is where I thought it would be really interesting to talk crude oil. Now, using options on futures is a little trickier because of the longer dated options are associated with the longer dated contracts. And like you've explained so many times about the term structure, it's a little trickier. So what I wanted to do was just keep it simple and focus on that USO contract on the short side. And this idea that, well, if the economy is not going to recover as fast as everyone thinks it is, then oil could easily gravitate to the bottom end of its trade range. And how do we profit if, let's say, oil was to go back, not go negative or anything like that, but retest some of the lows where the, you know, the July and August contracts were down in the 20s. And so in this scenario, what you can see on page 10 is with the USO trading at $26.29, again, out to October, 127 days on this position, what we're doing is a put back spread between the $27 and $23 strikes on crude oil. And so in the same spirit of what we did on the treasury bond trade, what you're doing is you're selling the one put option at the $27 at the money strike. It's slightly in the money for $3.65. So you're credited $365. And then you use the proceeds to buy two of those October 23 puts, which are $1.79 on the ask, and therefore it's a $358 debit. So you can see here that we have done this almost at a zero cost. Again, it was about a $7 net credit of a combination of the two. And now what we have is a scenario that if an economic recovery was still robust and oil shocks everyone by continuing to rise, we really lose nothing by the USO going higher through the life of the spread. But if oil starts to sell and heads right back down, and let's say the USO is going for a double bottom retest of its lows near, you know, $16, you're suddenly in a fabulous position to build a substantial intrinsic value on those put options as it heads lower. So when we look at chart 11, you can see that it's just the reciprocal chart of what we were doing, looking at for the call back spread, which is if oil goes higher from here, we're basically did a zero cost with very little carry. But at the same time, if we had a big drop in oil, you got that left tail of capturing that big move to the downside. Now, Eric, when we were talking about using this as an example, you immediately were pointing out, the flaws of that USO ETF as a way of expressing the trade. And even in your mind, you were talking about the idea that if we do have another drop in oil, that it probably would once again come at the front of the contract and potentially see the market back in contango. And so what I have on pages 12, 13, and 14 is a chart of the July futures contract, then overlaying the performance of the USO against that July contract, which is brutal tracking, obviously, because the USO now isn't in the front month anymore. And then you have your oil time spreads chart. So why don't you take us through what you were thinking on this?
Well, Patrick, as we've discussed before, USO is really a very imperfect instrument. Now, the way that it used to be structured, all of its position concentration was in the front month futures contract. That made it a pretty good instrument for playing on the short side, because usually when the market's selling off, the biggest sell-off usually happens on that front month contract, especially in a situation like we have now where storage is the driving force that's pushing the market down. The front month is what's going to sell off the fastest. Thing is, a lot of people were bottom feeding, trying to use USO as a long instrument, and it was really very, very badly suited to that, because you get killed in the contango roll every month. USO has to roll its position forward from the front month to whatever the next front month futures contract is. And if you're long USO as opposed to short USO, it's extremely inefficient. Now, they've been forced by market conditions to completely change their positioning. So I think now they're 10% in the front month contract. Actually, they're not at all in the front month contract. They're 10% in the second contract, 10% in the third, fourth, fifth, and it goes all the way out to June of next year. They have 15% or 10% of their exposure. I forget which. It's all over the place. So they're not as exposed now to some of the problems that were really problematic when we had a super contango market. All of a sudden, we don't have a super contango market anymore. So where USO's previous positioning was suboptimal in that market condition, their new positioning is suboptimal in this market condition. Because you'd really like to be, if you want to short this market, you'd like to be concentrated in the front month. That's where the best selling opportunity would be. And I don't think this is a coincidence. I think it's because USO has become so big that it literally is the existence of USO, the presence of those very large positions that USO held in the futures market was causing it to operate inefficiently. But all of that said, Patrick, at the end of the day, it still is a reasonable proxy for the oil market overall. It's not as sensitive to supercontango as it used to be, and there's a good and a bad side to that. For a short trade, as we're talking about here, it's really not optimal. The good news is that now that it's not as sensitive to super contango, when you try to use it as a long instrument, it works a little bit better. As we go on to page 14, we've got a picture here just showing the individual one-month time spreads. And we see that in April, there was just that nosedive right off the bottom of the chart there where we were getting to $4, $5, $6 of contango per month in the front end of the WTI crude oil term structure. Well, now even the widest of those spreads are like 25 cents. That's entirely consistent with a normal market when you don't have any pandemic crisis going on, when you don't have any special conditions. So I feel, and a lot of other people agree with me, that this market has moved too high, too fast in both flat price and in time spreads. I think we're overdue to see a little bit of retracement back to the downside. That would suggest that a short on oil is probably a good idea here, and particularly either a short on the front month contract or on some instrument which is going to benefit from the recurrence of deeper contango in the market. And again, USO is not optimal for that, but as you said, the only other option is to trade options on futures contracts, and that's beyond the ability of some traders. Certainly for our more advanced traders, I think the same trade that you're describing could be put on using options on the front month futures contract, but then you've got the problem when you're using this ratio strategy that you may need a little bit more time horizon. And as you described earlier, if you need that extra time horizon, you got to be dealing with a later contract. You don't have to go to what USO dictates, though. You can choose your own contracts if you're trading options on crude oil futures. So I think it depends on the sophistication of the trader and their familiarity with the markets. And of course, if you want to improve your familiarity with the markets, the way to do that is Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading. You can get a free trial. Sign up today. Just check out page 15. You got the link there for how to sign up for a free trial at Big Picture Trading. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's research roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to this chart book that we just discussed in the post game. There's also a Jeffrey Snyder article titled Attention All V People, as well as a Jesse Felder blog titled One for the Ages. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.